Many years ago, I was a youth pastor for a short stint before I went to seminary. Taught Sunday school class, taught a Bible study. One Sunday during Sunday school, I still remember the class. Don't remember the text. I don't remember why this illustration was important. But I asked the kids, one by one, there are a dozen or so of them, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, what do you want to be when you grow up? And many of them had an idea what they wanted to be. We had a couple of teachers, a firefighter. We had, I don't know who else we had. We had two or three that didn't know. And I said, that's okay. I said, now, when you're a teacher, when you're a firefighter, when you are whatever you're going to decide later to be, are you going to be so-so? You're going to be lousy, you're going to be so-so, you're going to be pretty good, or you're going to be great? Now, it was an interesting thing, you know, that you get real answers from young people that age. They usually tell you, and they told me, 100% of those kids was going to be great. There was nobody who was going to be bad. There was nobody who was going to be so-so. There was nobody who was just going to be good. 100% of them were going to be great. They were sure. Even the ones who didn't know what they were going to do. Whatever they were going to do, they were going to do it well. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon. Everybody wants to be great. Everybody, at least at first, expects that they're going to be great. And yet only a few achieve greatness. I could never find all of those kids now, but if I could, they're crowding 30 now. Some of them, I wonder how many of them are great at what they do. You know, the problem is not one of desire. They certainly had that, and we all have had that. The problem is that people go about being great in all the wrong ways. We want to be great. We have the desire. We expect that we're going to be great. But then we do things that are inconsistent with our desire to be great, and we wind up not being so great. Well, this morning I want to talk with you about how to be great. It's actually a subject that Jesus addressed. I'm not just going to make something up. I want to show you what he said about it. It comes up in our next text in the study of the Gospel of Mark. It's Mark chapter 9, beginning with verse 30. I'll give you a second to get there. We'll read today through verse 37. Mark 9, 30 through 37. From there they went out and began to go through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know about it. For he was teaching his disciples and telling them, the Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he has been killed, he will rise 3 days later. But they did not understand this statement, and they were afraid to ask him. They came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he began to question them, what were you discussing on the way? But they kept silent, for on the way they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest. Sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, if anyone wants to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all. Taking a child, he set him before them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me, and whoever receives me does not receive me, but him who sent me. Now, at the beginning of this passage, Jesus is talking again with his disciples about what has now become the main subject of his ministry to them. He's telling them how he is going to be killed. He's going to be rejected. He's going to suffer. He's going to be killed. And he's going to rise from the dead. He's preparing them for the event of the cross. It's coming. They need to be ready. They need to understand that this is the purpose of God, that this is the reason Jesus came, that his dying on the cross was God's design from eternity past. This has become the main subject of his ministry to them. It started when they affirmed him as the Messiah. Jesus said, who do you say that I am? And Peter spoke for the whole group and said, you are the Christ. And from that point on, immediately Jesus began teaching them that he was going to die. This was not just a chapter to finish so that they could move on either. This is the whole idea. This was not a phase of teaching to get beyond so we could get to the good stuff. This idea of suffering and rising again from the dead is the gospel. This is what the whole thing was about. It's the whole point of the endeavor, and Jesus keeps going over it because they don't get it, and so he keeps going over it. And now he's cut out the ministry to the crowds. He's taken all of his time with the disciples, and he's staying on this subject so that he can spend more time so that they'll get it. The Son of Man is going to suffer and die and rise again. He's very explicit. The wording is very explicit. Son of Man is going to be killed, and after he's killed, 3 days later he's going to rise again. How can you miss this? Well, in spite of the extra attention, in spite of the fact that we're going over it again and again, in spite of the absence of distractions from the crowd, they don't get it. They don't understand what he's talking about. They do know enough to know they don't get it, though. They're in that awkward place that we get sometimes where I don't quite understand, but I know I don't understand. I was pretty comfortable when I didn't even know that I didn't understand, but now I know I don't understand, and this doesn't feel good at all. You know, Jesus keeps going over this stuff, and I don't get it, and I don't like the way that feels. They at least realize they don't get it. It's a step in the right direction, but it's not a comfortable step. They're aware that there's something very important to Jesus that they don't understand. Matthew's account says that they were deeply grieved by this subject matter. And Luke says that the meaning was concealed from them. Sometimes God works in your life that way. You don't know something, you don't understand what he's talking about. You look at something in the scripture and you go, I don't know, I can't understand it. Sometimes God doesn't show you right away. And that's where these guys were. That's just the way it is. Until God shows you, you don't get it. You can't understand anything until he opens your mind to it. Things of God remain a mystery until you're saved, but some of them remain a mystery after you're saved for a time while God is showing you other stuff and you're going, what is that about? I don't get that at all. Now, there's a right response when that happens. The right response to coming up on a subject matter that you don't understand and you're frustrated because you don't understand it, you know you don't get it, is to keep asking God and keep thinking about it. With faith that he'll show you when it's time. And that would be the right response. You just keep on meditating on it. You keep on asking God in prayer to teach you about this thing that you don't understand. You prayerfully study and meditate and wait, and sooner or later, you'll know. And often God will wait. Often God will let you not know so that you have to keep coming back to him in prayer, so that you learn to meditate on his word, so that you think for a long time about it, so that you depend on him instead of on your intellect, so that you go, I don't know, I don't get that. But you keep praying and you keep asking and you keep thinking. And in time, God shows you that, and there'll be something else that you have to think about for a long time before you get it. Well, that would be the right approach. You just keep asking, keep studying, keep meditating. That is not, however, the approach the disciples took. They took the more common path. Verse 32, it says that they didn't understand this statement and they were afraid to ask him. So here these guys are in that uncomfortable place that every one of us has been. They know that they don't understand. Doesn't feel good. They're afraid to ask. You know, maybe they don't like the subject matter. It makes them uneasy. Something I'm going to have to give up if we keep going down this road. Maybe there were some attitudes there. You know, maybe they were just, you know, they could tell this was important and they don't want to be embarrassed in front of the other disciples. They're all kind of wanting to be on the top spot and you can't let the other guys see that you don't get it, you know. What, y'all don't understand that? Psh, ask him, man. I'm not going to tell you. Whatever the reasons were, though, here's what happened. They don't understand. They know they don't understand. They feel uncomfortable, so they forget about it and go think about something else. Put it out of your mind. Go on to something more of your liking. That's the more normal approach. Not the best, but it's common. In fact, these guys moved on to their heart's passion. Verse 33, it says, they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he began to question them, "What were you discussing on the way?" But they kept silent, for on the way they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest. Now Jesus waits till they're in the house. It's a long way back. They were way up in the north. I don't know, he was walking along all day. You get spread out. And as soon as they think Jesus is out of earshot, they start taking jabs at each other about who's the greatest. And the original language seems to indicate that this was one of those rather intense Christian discussions that normal people would call an argument. They were pretty hot about who was number one. They were getting in each other's face. They weren't doing it while Jesus was close, but they were doing it. And we see enough of these guys in the Gospels to know they weren't saying, "No, no, man, I'm not number one. You're number one. No, it's not me, it's you." It wasn't like that. And most of these guys thought they ought to be in the top spot, and if they didn't think they ought to be, they were going to pick sides, you know, picking and choosing like a political campaign. "I'm for Peter, I'm for John." Most of them, though, seem to just want to be on top, think they ought to be on top. Now, it could be that this particular argument came about because three of these guys had been up on the mountain and seen the transfigured Lord of glory, and maybe they're thinking that puts them in the running, you know. I can't tell you what happened on the mountain because Jesus said we're not going to talk about that, but I'm going to be on top. He didn't let you go. It was just us. You know, maybe it was the rebuke that Peter got that made everybody think there's an opening, you know. "Yeah, Peter, you're like, get behind me. Satan's going to put you in the top spot. I'm sorry. You're out, man. It's going to be me." They're arguing a lot. It goes on and on. Jesus lets it go on until they get inside, and then he asks them what they were talking about. Now, this must have been an awkward sort of a silence. You know something's up when these guys are ready to argue and talk and become very animated, and then Jesus says, what are you talking about? And they go, "Nothing." They wouldn't answer. Their consciences must have cried out. And so Jesus calls the class to order. He sits down. He calls them to himself. He begins to teach them about greatness. And what he says is so completely opposite from what you might think he would say that it may boggle your mind. Because Jesus does not say, "You guys stop wanting to be great, okay? Come on, get over it." He doesn't say that. He doesn't even say, "Stop wanting to be first." He doesn't say, "It's sinful for you to want to be somebody." It's not what he says. Now, a lot of people do preach that doctrine, put that in quotes. They tell you you shouldn't want anything. You don't want to be great, for heaven's sakes. As if the goal of life as a Christian is to become mediocre one day if I work hard. I'm going to exhaust myself in the pursuit of becoming so-so as a Christian. No, I mean, he doesn't say that. In fact, what Jesus does is encourages them to pursue greatness. He doesn't say don't want to be great. He doesn't even say don't want to be first. He tells them how to be first. Boil this down. He is in effect saying, guys, I know you want to be great, but you're going about it all wrong. Let me tell you how it ought to work. Let me tell you how you can be great. And then he teaches them the way to greatness. Now, I really believe that my encounter with the youth group all those years ago was not a fluke. I didn't happen to have the 12 kids out of all of Alpharetta, Georgia, who thought they were going to be great one day. You want to be great. I'm starting with that assumption today, that God has put in your heart a desire to be something much more than mediocre. That's how the youth group was. 100% of them were going to be great. They were sure of it. It's how these disciples were. They wanted to be great. They just wanted it. It wasn't just happenstance. There are some ambitions that are sinful, but ambition itself is not sinful. What happens is our sinful condition makes us misunderstand how to be great. It makes us want to cheat. It makes us define greatness in the wrong ways and try to hurt other people in order to get there. Wanting to be something more than so-so is a good thing, though. And Jesus tells every one of us exactly how to have it in this text. Before we get into that, though, there's a question that's screaming to be asked. If it's not a sin in itself to want to achieve greatness with your life, then why did these guys feel guilty? I mean, they did clam up when Jesus asked them. They were careful to be sure he was out of earshot before they had this discussion, argument. If it's not wrong, then why are they guilty? Why do they feel guilty? And the answer is that they felt guilty because what they were doing can't make you great. They were taking this godly desire to want to achieve something for His glory, to want to be something more than mediocre, to live well, to have an excellent testimony, to achieve good things. They took that good desire and they perverted it into selfish ambition. And it was sin. Sinful impulses were driving them. They had twisted what God gave them that was good. Their method was wrong. Their goals were wrong. The specific things that they were doing were prompted by sinful attitudes. Here's the secret that they missed. Nobody ever becomes great by vying for greatness. Nobody ever gets there that way. That's not the way. Nobody ever becomes truly great by trying to cut somebody else out of something so they can get in first place. You don't climb the ladder by yanking the guy ahead of you off the ladder and ever get where you ought to go. And these guys feel guilty because they were being selfish. They weren't thinking about the other disciples. They weren't thinking about God's best for their lives. They weren't thinking about how to serve Jesus. They just wanted what they wanted. And that's not the way to greatness. It's never the path. So in verse 35, Jesus, it says, sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, if anyone wants to be first, he shall be the last of all and servant of all. Now here is the way to be the greatest of all. You make yourself the last of all. You make yourself the servant of all. Now the verb to be in that sentence is in the middle voice in the Greek. It means it translates this way. If anyone wants to be first, he shall make himself to be last of all and servant of all. It's your job to make this happen to you. You make yourself become last. You make yourself become a servant. Now, this is so upside down to human thinking. And the disciples didn't get it for that reason. It doesn't come easy. And not getting this point that Jesus was making is why they didn't understand that he was going to die and be raised again. These things are actually related. This wasn't like Mark is just skipping around from subject to subject. This is why they couldn't understand that Jesus was going to die. They didn't understand greatness. God's ways are not like our ways. Selfish ambition may get you some short-term gains in this life, but it'll never help you to be truly great. It may enable you to pull somebody else down and take a position for a time, but it'll never get you greatness. Here's what God calls great. You intentionally make yourself last. You intentionally make yourself a servant to everybody. Now, don't miss the fact that this is intentional. That middle voice is important. Make yourself to be this. This is radically different from a job where you might call that a service job. People used to just call them servants, but you can't do that now because that sounds demeaning to people's ears. But go back in time 100 years and a servant served a person, or a person and his family, or a person and the family and the guests that come. There was a list of people. You're going to serve these people today. And for that, you're going to get paid. You know, that's not the kind of service Jesus is talking about here. It's not a quid pro quo kind of a situation. You do it and then you expect something because you did it. I did that, now you owe me one. That's not what he's talking about. This is talking about serving someone without regard for their status, without any expectation of any form of payment, without even a thought that they might one day return the favor, because if you're swapping favors, you're not last. You haven't made yourself to be last. If you're swapping favors with somebody, at best you're tied for last. And last is last. This is the way to be great. Now, often if somebody's going through a hard time and they're in a lowly position, Christians will try to encourage that person by saying, don't worry, God has something great for you someday. Think of the logic here. This is hard, I know it's hard, you're going through it, but God's going to give you something great one day. That's not quite what Jesus is teaching here. Because Jesus is not saying greatness comes from non-greatness. Which is what everybody's saying. You know, this is hard, this is not God's plan for you, but don't worry, this is going to make you great. Being not great now is going to make you great later. Man, if that worked, wouldn't it be a wonderful world? But greatness doesn't come from not being great. It just doesn't work that way. Jesus is saying humility is the path to greatness because humility is greatness. People see somebody in a humble condition and they say, man, I'm sorry. But one day God will fix it. No, this is it, man. We tend to think, well, it's not so great that I have to humble myself, but if I'm humble now, then God will make me great so I can be really proud later. I won't have to be humble anymore then. This isn't great at all, but then that'll be great when I can be proud. No. Humility is greatness. And this is consistently what the Bible teaches. Numbers 12, it says, now Moses was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth. I'll leave it to you to read the context, Numbers 12, but it's a high compliment that God's giving Moses. Humility is greatness. Nobody would say Moses was not a great man, and yet he was the most humble man on the face of the earth while he was alive. Humility is greatness. James and Peter both say the same words. God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Now, this is radically different from the way our fallen minds tend to work. We have to refit our value system. And yet, here it is. If we'll face it, if we're willing to believe it, this is the way to be great. You make yourself last. You make yourself a servant. Now that's not easy. I mean, that's not even easy to get our minds around. That's not how the world works. And so, Jesus is so gracious. These guys are having a hard time. We have a hard time. And so Jesus gives us an illustration of his point. Verses 36 and 37. Sitting down, he called... Oh, sorry, that's 35. Verse 36. Taking a child, he set him before them. And taking them in his arms, he said to them, whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me. And whoever receives me does not receive me, but him who sent me. So here's a small child. The Greek word means an infant or a toddler, something in that range. And so Jesus takes this kid and puts him on his knee or holds him in the crook of his arm or stands him up and puts his arm around him. And says, here is what I'm talking about. here is a child who can do nothing for you. This child can do nothing at all to help you achieve greatness in this world. Here is a child who has earned no privileges in life. Here's a child who has earned no respect yet. This child hasn't done anything. Now, children in that culture tended to be viewed with some indifference. They were certainly loved by their parents, but other people's children, people didn't have a lot of patience for them. They were kind of indifferent. They figure they're going to grow up one day, and when they do something to respect, I'll respect them. In the meantime, we'll just wait and see. It's kind of the prevailing attitude. They weren't able to contribute anything to adult conversation. They weren't able to contribute anything to adult understanding. When they grow up and they demonstrate that they're mature, then we'll respect them. When they grow up and they can do something for me, I'll do something for them. That's the way people thought. Really, people think that way a lot. Even today, if it's not their kid or their nephew or something close like that. Jesus said, you serve people like this. You serve people who can't help you. Serve people who haven't earned it yet. Who may not earn it. And then you're starting to get it. It's really not a better way to show how completely opposite Jesus' value system is from that of the world than to take this small child in his arm and say, you receive him and you receive me. This one who's helpless, this one who can't help you, this one who can give you no benefits, this one who's a lot of trouble. You receive this one and you've received me. Well, how does that make you great? Well, rendering service to the lowliest person means that you have served Jesus himself. You're pleasing him. And not only are you serving him, but you're serving the Father who sent him. This is what Jesus commanded us to do. It honors him. And it's always been God's value system. James 1:27 says, this is pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father, to visit orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world. Well, what are orphans and widows if you don't know them, if it's not your sister and your nephew and your niece? There's somebody who's going to cost you money. There's somebody, it's somebody who has no influence in this world, somebody who can't help you at all. Man, what a good test of what you really believe. If you'll help that one, you'll help anybody. That's how this works. It's a standard that's foreign to our normal pattern of thinking, but it's God's standard. And when you receive those who don't deserve it yet, who may never deserve it, who can't help you at all, then you receive Jesus and you receive the Father. Serve the weak and the helpless and you'll be great. Not one day out there you're going to be great. It is great. It makes you great because it is great. Jesus' teaching doesn't just point you to greatness out there one day, far in the future, after you get through this hard part of having to be humble. The humility is the greatness. Now, I know you want to be great. I don't even have to ask that question. Do you want to be great? God put it in you to want more than so-so out of the life he's given you. So the question is not whether you want to be great. The question is whether you trust God enough to embrace his value system so that you'll be on the path to greatness. Do you trust him enough to make yourself last of all? That's the way to be great, because it is great. Let's pray.